Morning, everybody. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is case number 55817, Lopez v. State. Mr. Phillips for the opponent, Mr. Sweden for the respondent. Mr. Phillips, you ready to proceed?
Good morning, Justices. For the record, I'm David Phillips, bar number 538. I represent Mr. Noe Perez. I would at this time ask to reserve at least 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal and at least 10 minutes for co-counsel with the Nevada Criminal Justice Association. I don't have much to say. I'm sure that you've read all of the briefs in this case, but I'm prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Well, tell us about Greenman.
Well, I wish I understood it as well as some people believe that it should be, that it is understood. Dr. Paglini has his ideas about it. Other people have theirs. Dr. Paglini has had no training in grooming. He has not written any articles, no peer reviews. He's not attended any conferences. He's not done any tests. In grooming, he didn't even interview the child victim in this case. We objected to it. We objected to his testimony, both on Dahlberg and on the Hallmark case. And even when you apply the Nevada Revised Statute Nevada Revised Statute 50.7275, his testimony did not qualify under that rule.
Well, why don't you start with the concept of grooming itself? Let's start with that as to whether grooming is something that should become before a jury in the child molestation cases.
I don't think it should. I believe that it's just too vague and ambiguous. According to Dr. Paglini, grooming is when there is an adult, and he only talked about males, not females, when there is an adult male who is either in the family or who is a friend or close to the family, or a neighbor who tends to, over a period of time, be it years, be it months, seems to get the favor of a child, and he begins to groom that child. He begins to give these favors with an intent or a purpose to have some sort of illicit or sexual contact with that child at a certain time in the future.
So, Mr. Phillips, you indicated that most of your objection to this testimony has to do with expertise. You're challenging it under a Daubert and a Hallmark. I guess my question is, tell me what was wrong with the testimony. I mean, you know, there was a suggestion, in fact, that he was vouching. I think that's something that you might want to talk about. But does he not have the adequate, were his qualifications not properly tested before the trial court? What's the problem with his testimony?
Well, Your Honor, the problem with his testimony is that he had not demonstrated what I consider to be the requisite experience to render an opinion in this case. He had not done any, as I stated before, any treatises. He had not done any particular studies in this, had done no tests, no clinical studies. He had not attended any conferences. I believe he said that he'd read some articles or talked to a couple of his colleagues in the same field. There were no writings by him. He had not written any articles. There were nothing on methodology, no peer reviews at all. He came in, and I believe at one point during his testimony, I objected, saying that he was a jack of all trades. His only experience was during, in the criminal sense, was during the pre-sentencing investigation reports. In fact, in this case, when it came to a sexual case, I believe his testimony was this is the only time he'd actually been brought in by the by the prosecution to testify in a sexual case. But I did not I did not agree that he had the requisite qualifications under Daubert or under Hallmark.
But of course, the trend in this area has to do more with some thought, if you will, that jurors are smarter now, and they're more educated now, and they know more about grooming, and so and then we don't have to have this type of testimony. I presume that that's, you would agree with that.
No. No. I don't think that jurors are that smart when it comes to something like grooming, especially in this case. I recall during the preliminary hearing even, when we, because of the way the testimony came in, there was a lot of inconsistencies in the testimony. Judge Herron had taken the case under advisement. She was going to render a written opinion in 30 days. This was at the preliminary hearing. During that time, the state then grand juried the case. During the trial itself, and even my colleagues, we felt pretty good that we had the jury. I mean, we were reading the faces of the jury, body language. We could see total confusion. And then Dr. Paglini comes in as a so-called expert, and he seals the deal for the state. I don't think that the jurors are that sophisticated when it comes to something to grooming. I don't think even I am that sophisticated on it. We've got, he testified to men only. I mean, nothing about women. He's talked about going on trips with a child, I mean, or giving a child a hug or giving a child a compliment or something like that. I do that every day with my kids, and so sure everybody else does. That does not mean that we're grooming them for some illicit purpose later. I believe it's just too speculative. I believe that in this case he did not have the requisite experience and that his testimony was irrelevant.
And your concern with respect to expertise has to do with the fact that he practices or has been known to practice primarily in the criminal arena as opposed to in the area of sexual exploitation of young children. Is that basically it?
On that particular point, yes.
Could you help me out on a point? It seems to me one of the essential pieces of testimony that's expert in nature is that it must assist the jury on a point that is material to the determination they're tasked with making. And in this record, you'll see some of the grooming cases will admit the testimony because you have a child witness who didn't report it for a long time, who reported it and completely recanted it, who was terrified, guilt-ridden, something to explain the child witness's recanted testimony, and it's sort of specially hemmed in. Some courts take that approach. What in this case was this testimony helpful to the jury in deciphering? Do you follow my question?
I'm not certain that it was helpful in having them understand the case because there was some recantation in this case.
But that was the wife, not the child, correct?
Correct.
Did the niece recant her testimony as well?
She did in the preliminary hearing. I'm not sure that you read that, had that testimony. I think that the jury, the way, I think they were assisted, but I think they were assisted with the state, not with the defense. And with the state, it would have been I believe that the jury was pretty much confused about the issue. I think there were some doubts, some reasonable doubt in the jurors' mind, until Dr. Paglini came on, and all of a sudden everybody's body language changed. They were all leaning forward, right, and taking notes and all that.
It's really a bolstering argument you're making, essentially, on that it didn't go to an issue that the jury needed outside expert help to elucidate, but rather strictly bolstering, which is inappropriate?
That's correct.
Do you know what the status is of the Diaz case in New York?
I do not.
Mr. Phillips, I know there's been discussions of Hallmark. We also had a criminal case, Higgs versus State, which discussed expert witnesses and discussed Hallmark and Daubert and all that. I was wondering if you thought that case had any applicability one way or the other.
Which case was that?
Higgs versus State.
I read it, I don't remember.
That's fine. My other question was on the timeliness of the notice on Dr. Paglini, your position on that.
We didn't get timely notice on that. And I believe we raised the objection to it, or I think we put that on the record. Had we had enough time, we'd have probably been able to get our own expert to assist or to rebut him.
Great, thank you.
I give you the hypothetical that Grooming is the correct standard to present in molestation cases and that Paglini was a proper expert. What about the probative value of what he said as to undue prejudice or irrelevant? Talk about the facts as to what he actually said that would have convinced the jury that you thought was going your way to go the other way.
Well, he was very specific about the facts of the case. The fact that my client had known his child for a long period of time. Over the course of his relationship with his niece, she was his niece, that he at some point turned and started favoring her over other kids. Now, Dr. Paglini made the statement that it's potentially that she may have been a child that had some issues with her own, with the way she was being perceived by other people. I'm forgetting it in turn. She was a child that was probably quite vulnerable to him. He was able, because she was an easy target, not using his terms, an easy target for him to show favor to this person, that she would not be likely to say anything to her parents about it, she was easy for him to have time alone with. He would show favor, take her on trips, buy her things, take her to Disneyland. She'd ride to the store with him. He would compliment her a lot when no one else would. All of which I thought was irrelevant in this case.
Mr. Phillips, in light of the fact that the doctor hadn't examined the child, were you able to bring that out on your cross-examination?
I did. I asked him about that. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yeah.
And also asked you the various comments, as you're alluding to, the fact that he didn't interview
Correct.
The child.
Correct. I brought that out on cross-examination, that he had not interviewed her, had not interviewed any of the parties. His testimony was that he just read the records, read the reports that were involved. I tried to get deeper into his methodology of coming up with this whole grooming idea, but I was overruled several times.
But the record would suggest that the doctor was offered primarily for testimony dealing with, quote, grooming techniques used upon children. So in that general arena, why would he necessarily need to know anything else about the record of this particular child? In fact, if that's the nature of his expert testimony was to talk about that in general, why is the fact that he didn't review records or documents relevant?
Well, Your Honor, because his whole testimony, even though he was brought in to talk in general, the jury looked at him as if he's an expert for this case. We objected to that testimony, his testimony in this case. The jury looked at him as if he was, quote, the man.
But you were not precluded, for instance, from cross-examining him with respect to, have you evaluated this child, have you seen records?
Right.
You did all of that.
I did all of that, yes. Yes.
Anything further?
I would yield to counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Robert Arroyo, and I'm here on behalf of the Nevada Attorneys for Criminal Justice. This court asked us to weigh in on the general relevance of grooming testimony. And as we looked at the record of this case, two things kind of stood out to me in that regard. And when we started looking at the statute that governs admissibility of experts, I think I would agree with the District Attorney's Association on this point. I don't know if I've ever said that before, but in this case I do. The statute on expert testimony considers that these type of decisions should be made on a case-by-case basis in front of the judge. We give the presiding judge discretion to determine the relevance and the reliability, you know, on a case-by-case basis, because sometimes, especially on grooming, which the state asserts is based upon the experience of Paglini, so there's no telling whether or not two different experts are going to have the same experience or the same exposure. So we would request that this court not to make a general ruling regarding grooming and allow the district courts to determine this on a case-by-case basis. The other part that kind of stood out to me as I was looking at this is the manner in which courts are to make that case-by-case basis. Looked at the Como case, the Como Tire case that the United States Supreme Court decided, and the Scalia concurrence I thought was very helpful. And he says that the discretion in choosing the manner in which we determine the reliability is not the discretion to just ignore that gatekeeping function, nor is it the discretion to perform it inadequately. That discretion means that the judge has to choose between legal means of determining reliability and relevance. And when we look at the record in this case, the district court here did not really flesh out the data or the experience or the qualifications of Mr. Pavlini to make the conclusions that he did make in this case. So we would ask that any opinion that this court rendered give some guidance to district courts that, yes, you do have the discretion to choose the means of determining reliability, but that has to be reasonable considering the facts. And I guess in different cases and different topics, that is going to vary. When we're talking about medical examiner testimony, I don't think any inquiry needs to be as in-depth as compared to this grooming, where we really don't see any case law, or I haven't found any previous case law from this court. So it's not a case where a district court could take judicial notice of the reliability of grooming techniques. And so as we were going through this and we were going to comment on the grooming, we didn't really have a sufficient basis on this record to discuss Dr. Paglini's data that underlies his conclusion.
So in other words, Mr. Royer, you would suggest then that an adequate record needs to be made below where all of the typical testing of experts' testimony and the admission and or the admission thereof should be done on each case precisely so that should there become a review such as the one we're looking at here today, this court could clearly see what the judge did, what was tested by the defendant, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that. I think, you know, that serves two bases. One is to ensure that a defendant or the state has a fair trial. And two, when we get to this level of review, we have a sufficient record.
Right now, there's never been any other challenge or testing of expert testimony. We can treat this area of grooming much like we do any other area, or should, in fact, if we trust in our trial judges to do that adequate testing of the evidence.
Yes, I do agree with you. I do agree that there is some danger to this type of testimony. I think Justice Pickering was kind of getting into it, that kind of treads the line of bolstering the credibility. But there may be some situations in which it is appropriate or not, but
could you make the argument, and I'm going to ask the state for its side of the same argument, tell me why, in your estimation, this testimony was not helpful to any issue that the jury was faced with deciding? Or are you not that close to the record?
I have reviewed the record. I don't want to say that I'm as versed in the record as Mr. Phillips, sorry.
But an important part of this determination, case by case, I agree with you completely, but one key point to assessing expert testimony is it has to help the jury decide a question that the jury is tasked with deciding. This jury was tasked with deciding what occurred in Las Vegas in the Luxor Hotel. And how did all of this background testimony about grooming in California help the jury decide a material fact in issue in this case?
In this case, I don't think it was too helpful, especially considering Dr. Paglini's testimony in this case, which was very speculative. I don't know if he was able to even give an opinion whether or not this behavior was actually grooming. And I think the second part is, I don't know if this behavior was really outside the common understanding of a jury. And this isn't really like a Joe Sandusky case where you have this elaborate foundation and you're picking out, you know, certain victims. This case, it really seems like at a certain point, it's alleged that maybe he became sexually attracted to his niece as she got older and then kind of just went through, I know this may sound bad, but normal kind of flirtatious behavior. If it was between two adults, I think a jury is well equipped to determine whether or not that was inappropriate behavior or if that was, the jury could determine, is in a good position to determine what intent, if any, he had in this case. Just by our
common
understanding.
Did the state ever tie up the fact that the grooming bore on credibility, for example?
And I don't think I am prepared to answer that based upon the record, so I'm going to mislead this court. So in conclusion, and just summary, I just think that in this case, we really don't have a sufficient record to talk about grooming in any detail. You know, in Pedlin's testimony, it's not just observations he goes into. He really goes into different factors, the purpose of the factors. He goes into the frequency of disclosure between if the person grooming the expert is a stranger or non-stranger. We really know, you know, the comparison that he did. What is the basis of that study? We know he has 1,000 psychosexual analysis that he does, but we don't know how many of those actually involved grooming, what he used to determine this behavior and predict behavior. So I think this case leaves a lot more questions about grooming than it answers. So we would ask the court not to make any general rulings and to give guidance supports that if they are going to allow us this type of testimony, that they employ reasonable means to determine the reliability of it.
You think the defense bar will be equipped if we find that grooming is appropriate, that grooming is appropriate, to counter this type of testimony down the line in every case where we're not dealing with a stranger but a relative who has a period of contact with an alleged child victim?
I'm not sure I understand it. Are you asking?
What I'm saying is if we say this is fine, okay, we can come with Sweden and the DA, all the district attorneys, this is good, grooming testimony. Are we going to see grooming expert testimony in every case that involves a relative or close friend of a child rather than a stranger? In other words, stranger case where there's molestation, it's unlikely there'd be grooming. A stranger comes along and molests a child. But in every case where there's a relative, an uncle, a grandfather, a father, especially these the male victims, are we going to see grooming in every particular case? And if we do, is the defense bar going to be able to counter this?
I think that's a real danger, is that, you know, as I was getting to, there's just the difference between acceptable behavior and this criminal intent is really, as the line's not clear. So as I think Dr. Pagnini testified, this normal type of touching behavior, or that you see a grandfather playing with his grandson kind of wrestling, I mean, it could be grooming in almost every case by being so. So I think if we do just have, if you do say that grooming is fine, that you are going to see this pop up in every single case. In terms of dealing with it, I think that maybe with a better record, you know, knowing what the data is, that the defense attorneys may be equipped and maybe have their own expert. I think at this point it would just be speculation on my behalf. But I think if there was a better record, as the data and the methods used by the expert to determine this would have given the defense attorney a better shot at cross-examining on this type of testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Royer.
Thank you.
Mr. Sweden, on behalf of the state of Nevada.
May it please the court. My name is James Sweden of Clark County District Attorney's Office, and with me is Terrence McCarthy, who was invited by the court to present amicus brief. I'll be making the oral argument this morning. If the court wants to hear from Mr. McCarthy, he's certainly available, but won't speak unless he's requested to. As I start my argument, I go to Justice Pickering's question, and that is, what is the relevance of this testimony? And I think the easiest way to see that, the relevance, the application, the probative value of Dr. Pat Glidden's testimony as to grooming, can best be understood if we consider first the facts of the case, the charges that the state, that the defendant was charged with, as well as the burden which the state carried. Now, the defendant was charged with several counts of two crimes. The first is sexual assault with a minor under the age of 14. The second is lewdness with a child under the age of 14. Now, as to the sexual assault with a minor count, the jury was instructed as to the elements of that count, which are that a person who subjects a minor under 14 years of age to sexual penetration against the minor's will or under conditions in which the perpetrator knows or should know that the minor is mentally or physically incapable of resisting or understanding the nature of his or her conduct is guilty of the crime of sexual assault with a child under the age of 14. Now, in this case, we have a child who's 13 years of age. She came on a trip here to Las Vegas with her uncle, who was about 33 years at the time, and her uncle's wife, who was her aunt. They got here to Las Vegas. They all stayed in the same hotel room. As they were here in Las Vegas, there was testimony adduced at trial that, in fact, there was conduct going on between the victim and the defendant, which was sort of flirting activity. They were touching each other. They were joking with each other. They were holding on to each other. There was testimony from the victim in this case that, in fact, she made statements to the defendant like, wouldn't it be nice if we were here alone? I'd love to just be alone, just you and me. And then the defendant making statements a short time after that, I was just going to say that to you. Now, it was under this backdrop that while the defendant's wife is taking a shower inside the hotel room and the defendant and the victim are alone in the common areas of the room, that the defendant takes the victim, he lays her on the bed, he pulls down her pants and undergarments, and subsequently penetrates her as well as lewdly touches her. Now, as to the sexual assault counts, the state had to show that the sexual penetration, as I indicated earlier, was either against the victim's will. Now, the respondent would submit to the court that in this case, that's a very difficult showing to make given these facts. The child testified that she didn't resist this conduct, and we've got this other testimony that he made reference to of this sort of flirting activity that was going on, of the statements that were being made in this context. Or the state had to make a showing that the penetration was under conditions in which the perpetrator knows or should know that the minor is mentally or physically incapable of resisting or understanding the nature of his or her conduct. And in this case, this is where the state focused its efforts. You know, the idea is that this defendant was the uncle of this 13-year-old child. He had known her since her birth, as the testimony was stated. He acted in this niece and uncle relationship over all these years. It'd be very unusual. How do you explain the conduct of the victim in this case as she just lays on the bed as he commits these acts upon her? You explain that by showing the jury what actually was the case here, that there was a situation created by the defendant where the child's will of thought processes were overborne. Now, I'd note that we prosecute, I'm assigned to a team that specifically prosecutes these cases, and we prosecute many cases where we don't bring in grooming testimony. For instance, if we had a case where we had a 5-year-old child who was being sexually penetrated by an adult family member, well, in that case, there probably is a course of grooming activity that occurred. But with a 5-year-old child, it's much more evident that that child did not have the ability to consent to that penetration. But that's a much more difficult decision to make when you have a 13-year-old girl who's maybe sexually developed in some way.
Mr. Sweden, based upon what you've laid out thus far, that brings us to the issue of the qualifications of this expert that's been offered. And so why don't you speak to that in light of what you've laid out. You've laid out a need for an expert. Tell us why the qualifications of this expert met muster.
Well, first let me say that in regards to grooming testimony on itself, it is a very, it's not a real complicated area. And that's why I said that in many cases we don't need to present a grooming expert, because it's not as poignant of an issue.
For this particular case, you already made the case that you needed to bring in an expert.
And
so
then
you talk to the qualifications.
Yes.
And why this one, or why he had or did not have, sufficient expertise.
And he was amply qualified in this case, and I'll tell you why. But I would like to mention that there are cases of individuals, police officers, testifying to this and being recognized as experts.
That's not the facts we have here. We'll deal with that another day.
In this case, we have a much more qualified expert. Dr. Paglini clearly had specialized knowledge in the area of sexual abuse and one of the tactics sex offenders use to prey on victims, that of grooming. He testified to his qualifications. He has a bachelor's degree in psychology. He has a doctorate degree in clinical psychology. He's licensed clinical psychologist for 18 years. He spent the last 12 years working with family courts doing child custody evaluations, domestic violence, and on sex abuse cases. He's a clinical psychologist, I indicated, and as a clinical psychologist, he testified that he's trained to evaluate and understand human behavior. He indicated that he has prepared 1,000 psychosexual evaluations over a course of 8 years, and he detailed exactly what those sexual evaluations or psychosexual evaluations are. They're a sexual history of the defendant. They detail the methods that are employed to violate victims. He determines whether defendants present high or low risk to reoffend. He evaluates relationships between sex offenders and victims. And if the offender, he evaluates if the offender is using grooming techniques on his victims. This is a part of his analysis in identifying the existence of a grooming pattern as a key part of preparing the psychosexual evaluation and coming to a risk assessment. This is what he does. He's done it over the period of eight.
He wrote down the percentage of those evaluations that fell under the grooming banner, opposed to just a general psychosexual evaluation as to sexual assault or abuse.
In this testimony, I endeavored, and I think I brought out in testimony, that grooming is a consideration that he uses in every evaluation. Because as he does an evaluation, he has to look at various tactics, various things. Grooming is one of those things, so it's something that he evaluates in every case that he does. And as he, in this particular case, Dr. Kat Paglini was very clear that he was only testifying to this area of grooming. He was just describing what grooming was, what effect it might have on children. That's all he was doing.
Mr. Sweetney, if we accept the fact that he's met, you've decided you needed him for testimony, and you've met Justice Douglas's concern with respect to, you know, adequate qualifications, you've met Justice Pickering's concern about relevance, my question then is, assuming all of that to be true and we find it okay, you know, no harm, no foul, how do we distinguish that type of testimony, or how do we protect against that type of testimony becoming vouching or bolstering in a situation like this where you might have a witness who's a little bit on the fence or not a particularly good witness? That is a great concern to me after we get through all those other checklists.
And, you know, courts have laid out their concerns in regards to vouching. And actually, in this brief, I did a couple cases that particularly talk to that. And just to say that, I believe that those cases actually support the use of the testimony here and kind of reinforce my statement that, in fact, it was not vouching in this case. They cite these New York cases essentially for this proposition, and those cases are clear that if there is a reason for the admission of the evidence other than merely to show the sexual assault is more likely to have happened or not, it's admissible. Now, in this case, I've mentioned that it's very probative in regards to making that one element in regards to the sexual assault. But it's also relevant in regards to showing the intent, the sexual intent in regards to the touching to gratify either the defendant or the recipient in this case. And I'll clearly disclose to you that I'm not sure that it's as probative in that area because the defendant makes statements where he, in fact, says that he did touch her and that he had a love for her and he was sexually attracted to her. But in that same statement, he clearly does not admit pulling down her pants and even makes a statement that there was some friction on the bed that might have pulled her pants down and that sort of thing. And that statement, actually, the statement to the police was disputed in the defense case. But that is clearly relevant for that purpose, and it's also relevant to show in this case, immediately after the victim disclosed.
Let me pause you there. It's relevant on the defendant's conflicting statements, grooming is? Explain that to me.
No, I'm sorry. I must have misstated. I'm trying to show how it's relevant not only to the sexual assault counts and the elements associated with that, but also to the lewdness charges and the element of intent to sexually gratify. This course of conduct under...
Why did you need that? He already said he had feelings for her, etc. The issue that's really troubling me in this case is if we grant you that this testimony is relevant, I don't see how it doesn't come in every single sexual assault case with a child or young teen.
Well,
it's concerning because you go on for 40 or 50 pages with this defendant, and basically it's almost a sentencing concept that he's likely to reoffend, he doesn't understand boundaries, he's cunning and beguiling to young children, that sort of testimony. What's the limits on it? I think it needs to be cabined by what it tends to help the jury decide.
And I understand what you're saying, Justice Pickering. And in this case, the state attempted to do everything it could not to create that situation. And the way we did that was to merely have this witness describe what grooming was, to not have him render any opinions as to whether grooming was occurring in this case. And the testimony that was elicited through this expert was essentially that the elements of grooming, there were some hypotheticals that were posed to the defendant, would this potentially constitute grooming activity? He was very clear in cross-examination, made it even clearer, that many of those things could just as easily have been something that was innocent as opposed to something that was grooming activity. But the context in which it was laid out was such that the jury could decide whether or not this course of conduct that was engaged in was grooming or was not.
So if you had to write an opinion in this case and say what this testimony was relevant to in this case, your answer would be?
It's relevant to prove material elements of the crimes charged in regards to the sexual assault, to show so that
the witness's will was overborne without her knowing it.
Yes.
That would be one point.
Yes.
Anything else?
The other point would be that, in fact, the defendant is sexual intent as he touched the child. The child was on the bed. He was touching her. We have to show that he had the intent to either sexually gratify himself or the child. And I think that the history of grooming would ultimately be relevant to that. But as I said,
Explain that to me? I don't get that.
Certainly. In this case, if in fact the jury were to consider, well, maybe he was helping her adjust her hair, or he was helping her adjust her bra, or whatever it might be, that might be a reason for him to touch without sexual intent. He put at issue, although he did make statements to the police initially in regards to his love for this child, at trial, certainly he stepped away from that, challenging the voluntariness of those statements.
So how does that differ from just plain propensity type evidence?
Well, it's not offered to show that the defendant was predisposed to commit these crimes. It was offered to show that the defendant had a sexual attraction to this particular child.
Okay.
And getting back to the issue that you had in regards to vouching, Justice Sada, in the Taylor case, the victim did not initially disclose that she knew who the perpetrator of the sexual assault upon her was, although she later disclosed that to the police sometime after she had initially talked to her, and the court found that expert testimony about rape trauma syndrome was admissible to explain the delay in the victim reporting. Thus, it wasn't vouching. It had a purpose, absent of just trying to paint the defendant as a bad person or to show he's more likely to have offended than not. That's the case we have here. In the Diaz case, the court found that expert testimony by a psychologist that it was not unusual for child victims of sexual assault not to report the abuse immediately, and when they did report, to reveal the full extent of the abuse only gradually in bits and pieces. That was properly admitted. However, the testimony in that case offered by the expert to describe how the sex offender typically operates to win over the trust of victims was found not to be admissible because it was not used to explain the behavior of the child that might appear unusual or that jurors may not be expected to understand. That's precisely why the evidence of grooming in this case was presented.
Was there anything here, though, like in some of those cases where the child did not report it for a long time, so there was some question about the child's credibility in reporting it as when and as she did? There's nothing like that in this case, is there?
Actually, in this case, the child originally, when contact is made with the child by the police, she discloses some of the touching, but not all of the touching. And there was testimony elicited through Dr. Paglini, just in the framework of grooming, you know, of considerations that might present themselves due to the grooming process, or the things the jury might want to consider, or could consider in that regard, as to whether or not essentially the grooming might have played a role in that.
Counsel, may I interrupt your response?
Yes, Justice Sotomayor.
Assume for the moment that the testimony was relevant and probative on the sexual assault count, but was really propensity on the lewdness count. Should there be a limiting instruction or a qualification in the instructions dealing with such evidence when that is the case?
Well, taking your scenario, if the evidence has a specific purpose to be presented and should be presented, I would not agree with your premise that it's propensity in regards to the other, but if that were the conclusion that you reached, certainly the court has to protect the defendant in a case. If there is evidence that the court determines that is propensity evidence, the court, you know, might instruct the jury in that regard. I don't think that that's the case in this case.
So I appreciate the fact that your view is that this evidence was probative and relevant on both counts. But to the extent that one might disagree in its in the evaluation of the lewdness count, and therefore if such an instruction is necessary or qualification is necessary, should this be retried? Would there be harmless error on the lewdness count?
Well, in this case, the state would submit the evidence was very, very strong in this case. The victim testified clearly as to what happened. The defendant's wife, as it turned out at trial, indicated what had happened initially, although she sort of recanted at some point. That was clearly placed before the court. The defendant admitted what happened to the police. So the evidence was very substantial in this case, and the state would submit that the issue in regards to Dr. Paglini's testimony of just informing the jury of what grooming was certainly would be was a minor part of this case, the state would submit.
Mr. Sweetman, at the timeliness of the notice of Dr. Paglini's testimony to defense, could you explain your position on that?
The timing of the notice? It was noticed pursuant to statute. I believe there was notice that was initially provided on September 2nd, 2009. Which was clearly outside of that time required, and that notice did include his name, his address, as well as a brief statement of what his testimony would be as required by statute. Now, I know appellant has made issue in regards to whether or not he was provided with reports that might have been generated by Dr. Paglini. Dr. Paglini did not generate any reports in this case. He was merely testifying in an educational fashion as to what grooming was. He didn't interview anybody. He didn't do any reports in regards to this case. In the course of proceeding in the case, defense filed their motion to exclude Dr. Paglini, and there was even further discussion specifically as to what he would testify to. Clearly, defense was put on notice pursuant to statute and very, very clearly in process and form as to this testimony that it was coming in and what it would entail.
Mr. Sweetman, as to that, you're indicating that the notice was generally that he would testify as to the general nature of grooming. Mr. Phillips seemed to indicate that he also testified, though, based upon his review of the record and the facts in this specific case, not generally, but a little more specifically, without having should we separate that notice should be specific as to general or specific facts?
Well, I would dispute with Justice Douglas that that is what actually happened. At all times, the respondent would submit to the court that Dr. Paglini merely testified as to the grooming process. He was given some hypotheticals, and he testified in regards to those hypotheticals.
The hypotheticals case specific, or were they general?
Well, the hypotheticals were general, but they related to things that happened within this case. He never testified in regards to resources that he or anything that he had outside of the record. That never happened. He merely testified in response to hypos that were posed to them, which case law clearly lays out is appropriate. And I would note that one thing, and I don't know if I finished your question.
I think you did, but it was designed to see whether or not, as Mr. Phillips at least had, my ear had caught, that he was saying the testimony was specific based upon Dr. Paglini's review of the records opposed to general testimony. That's why I queried you.
Yeah, and I would dispute that, the record would reflect that.
Why is this witness allowed to give general testimony rather than being expected to interview the child witness?
Because the purpose of his testimony only is to give context to the evidence that was already introduced. There was a motion filed in court to bring in the evidence in regards to this chain of events that occurred in California leading into Las Vegas. That was granted. At this point, the state has to say, well, how do I explain the relevance of this testimony to the jury? And the state submits, or the respondent submits, that in this case, the only way to do that would be to just lay out what is grooming, allow the jury to be able to determine whether or not this, in fact, fits into this grooming category and what the effects of grooming might be, because that goes to essentially determining what effect this had on the victim, which is the primary reason it was submitted.
Why won't the district attorney have this witness, Paglini, who everybody's familiar with in the criminal justice system in Clark County, interview the child victim?
I'm not sure what an interview with the child would provide. To have him generate an opinion in regards to whether or not this child was groomed herself. And the state would submit that would certainly be much, potentially certainly much more prejudicial to the defendant than the manner in which the testimony was presented. The state would believe that the manner in which the testimony was presented essentially accomplished an educational process so the jury on their own could make that ultimate decision as to whether the child was groomed or not.
I have my criminal hat on, now I'm going to put my civil hat on. I don't think in a civil case you could have this type of testimony as to general, that it's generally product liability or it's generally negligence without aligning it to the specific case. Well, I'm wondering, why is it different in the criminal justice system that we're allowed to have this type of testimony without it being specific on a case-by-case basis? This is not specific. This is general testimony.
In the Shannon case, which was cited, I believe, in the state's answering brief, that was a case which I'm sure Justice Cherry is well aware of.
I was the arbitrator at the school district on that case with the children.
And in that case, we had basically the same situation we have here. We had an expert come in and testify to educate the jury in regards to conduct that might be consistent with grooming. Exactly what we have here, Justice.
I'm just curious as to why the district attorney would not have him talk to the... everybody that watches Law and Order now, and Law and Order, Dr. Wong always talks to the victim. I just want to make sure that we're not opening the door to a new profession where the state will call Paglini and then the defense will find somebody who will say it's not grooming in this particular case. And now we have a grooming issue. It's only grooming, and we're not to the specifics of whether a child was molested or not. I worry about that.
Well, and as I indicated, I'd like to stress to the justices that this is not the type of thing that the state does on a regular basis. It's only done when it's absolutely necessary. And in this case, respondent would submit that it was necessary to show the jury, so that the jury might understand why this child would lay on the bed and not protest. It was necessary.
Mr. Sweeten, Mr. Arroyo was particularly concerned about us making a pronouncement today by and through this case, wherein we set out some type of a broad statement about grooming testimony, and in fact he urged us to be sure that whatever we decide, that it is clear to our trial judges that this should be on a case-by-case basis, very much like the analysis that you just set out. Is this a situation where this is appropriate consideration? I assume you're going to agree with that, but my question is, did the judge do that in this case? Are we adequately protected on this particular record?
Yes, Judge. I would agree that there shouldn't be a per se rule, that the courts are in a much better position as they evaluate everything before them to make a decision, and they're well equipped to do that. And I believe that in this case, the court certainly did that.
Are you familiar with the Intermediate New York Court of Appeals case in Diaz?
I'm not sure. I'm familiar with the Diaz case. I'm not sure.
It's pending on review to the New York Court of Appeals. And in that case, the Intermediate Court held that it was reversible error to have admitted the grooming testimony, not because grooming testimony is per se inadmissible, but because there was nothing, no behavior of the victim that appeared unusual, that the jurors might not be able to understand, and concluded that the sole purpose in the case before it was to bolster the testimony of another witness, and therefore it should not have been admitted. That's pending. But it suggests what I'm trying to understand the limits are on why you say you don't use grooming in every case. It's only the rare and exceptional case that you would have put in this testimony. But I'm trying to understand what case involving a family member engaging in inappropriate sexual activity with a young teen, under your view of things, where you've charged sexual assault, is there ever a case where this grooming testimony would not be admissible? And if so, what distinguishes this case from that?
Well, you know, I think that it's a call that needs to be made factually by the district court as they consider this. But I believe that there probably are situations where the grooming testimony might not be as probative, certainly as it was in this case. Whether it's relevant or not, and potentially admissible, if there's a course of grooming and it has relevance to the case, I think it would be.
By your analysis, every sexual assault case would have this issue in it if the child yielded to the family member's inappropriate advances, correct?
Only if there was a course of conduct that would suggest grooming. And I'm not sure that that's the case in every case. There are a number of other considerations that might be had in regards to the state of the evidence in the case, other statements, eyewitnesses, a litany of potential.
Here you had the wife come out of the bathroom and allegedly see her husband with their niece. She cries bloody murder and the security guards come. I mean, what more would you have needed? I'm just not sure how this grooming evidence did anything but prejudice the defendant.
Well, in this case particularly, that witness who came out and made the observations actually recanted her testimony.
So you're using it to vouch for her original statement?
No, I'm using it to show why the victim acted the way that the victim did when she was perpetrated upon.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Sweeten. Mr. McCarthy, would you like to say something on behalf of the District Attorneys Association and our brothers and sisters in the Northern Nevada?
Thank you for the kind invitation.
Please take a couple minutes.
Okay.
And I'll give them some extra time if you'll need it, Mr. Phillips.
I wasn't going to, but I'm Terry McCarthy, generally employed as a deputy DA in Washoe County, and today on behalf of the Nevada District Attorneys Association. And I'm glad to see someone agreed with me that we don't need a special rule And I had some thoughts as the arguments were proceeding, and one of them is, in most cases, there isn't something that would constitute grooming. But and so that eliminates most of the cases, since it's just not factually available. But second is, I think it is counterintuitive, and that's why we need an expert in certain kinds of cases here. People expect that their child would react in a certain way. I would expect my child is going to be kicking and screaming if someone is acting sexually inappropriate. And so that's where we use this educational process to explain to the jury that sometimes people don't act the way we expect them to. And this is what happened here. It's the grooming that leads to the lack of protest by this victim. So I think that's unusual enough that I don't think we need worry about opening the floodgates. But that would be the relevance, I think.
On that point, Mr. McCarthy, I think that illustrates the need for the testimony, perhaps in the sexual assault case, but not necessarily in the lewdness case.
I find it stronger in the lewdness case because motive is an element. And planning to commit a crime is just about the best evidence of motive I can imagine. And speaking of the best, I also think that's a marvelous qualifications of the doctor, with whom I am not familiar, by the way. But it seems to me that interviewing a bunch of sex offenders is a pretty good way to get the education and experience necessary to render an opinion about sexual conduct of others. I heard a beep in the red light, so thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Mr. Phillips, a rebuttal to Mr. Sweet and Mr. McCarthy?
Yes, very briefly.
You've got over 10 minutes.
Okay. First of all, I would like to direct your attention. I'll set the record on our cross-examination of Dr. Paglini on page 74. I believe it starts with line 9, and then we go to line 13, where his answer, where I ask him if he'd had an opportunity to review any records, and when he says, I've read the statements by the alleged victim, by the alleged perpetrator, by the alleged perpetrator's wife, the preliminary hearing transcripts, the arrest report, and the indictment. Now, we were given a notice, and all that the notice said was that it was part of their witness list that he would testify as to grooming techniques used upon children. But we did not receive a proper notice. The notice that was given was pretty much blindsiding us. We would have gotten someone, a grooming expert or an expert of our own to counter him had we received it properly. Now, Dr. Paglini, he testified that he had done over 1,000 examinations or whatever. The question that, one thing that bothered us during the trial, and we tried to pull it out, was that he has made all these evaluations on grooming, but there was no standard, no methodology for his techniques of questioning these people in the pre-sentence reports or psychosexual evaluations for grooming. We don't know. He said he was doing these examinations and that was part of the examination, but we don't know what standard he used.
Mr. Phillips, before you get too far into that subject, I want to just back up to where you were. You took us to page 74 of the transcript, but later, somewhere between 76 and 78, you kind of spar, if you will, with the kind doctor, as any good defense attorney would do in cross-examination. But ultimately, after that series of questions that you just pointed us to, Dr. Paglini gives you real trouble. He says, I didn't purposely evaluate this witness. I didn't purposely evaluate the defendant. I knew that was not my role. And in fact, he says, and I quote, the goal was to educate the jury just on what grooming is. So, okay, it's an educational component. So didn't we kind of wrap that up nicely in front of the jury to be sure that he wasn't really offering an opinion on whether or not grooming occurred in this case? And or vouching for any of the witnesses?
No, I don't think so, because, as I stated, during that trial, the jury looked at, we were there. I mean, it's one thing to read it, it's another to be there, to observe the body language of the people in the room. And we were pretty much sold on that. We were ahead in this case. We thought we had run it until Dr. Paglini came in and sealed the deal for the state. I had objected to his testimony, objected to it as being relevant. I objected to what happened in California versus to what happened in Nevada. We know about the so-called grooming today. It supposedly happened over a period of time. I thought that what happened in California was totally irrelevant. If he had coming into Nevada, he was only a couple of days, for anything that would be relevant. I felt that the jury was still on my side until Dr. Paglini testified. And I think that's what sealed the deal for him. His testimony, I thought there was some undue prejudice to my client in this case. And that's why we filed the notice of appeal, and we believe that this case should be ruled in favor of the defendant and given a trial.
Any further? Ms. Royal, do you want to say anything in rebuttal?
Thank you.
I
believe that's it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you.
Mr. McCarthy, Mr. Sweetman, Mr. Royal, Mr. Phillips, thank you for your arguments and the briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted, and this court will be in recess until 11:30.